Strange studies of strange stories.
King Poliander Partabon, ruler of Siberia, was a great warrior, and being an advocate of the methods of modern strategy, above all else, he prized cybernetics as a military art. His kingdom swarmed with thinking machines, for Poliander put them everywhere he could, not merely in the astronomical observatories or the schools, but he ordered electric brains mounted in the rocks upon the roads, which with loud voices cautioned pedestrians against tripping. Also in posts, in walls, in trees, so that one could ask directions anywhere when lost. He stuck them onto clouds so they could announce the rain in advance. He added them to the hills and valleys. In short, it was impossible to walk on Siberia without bumping into an intelligent machine.
That was the opening paragraph of Tale of the Computer That Fought a Dragon by Stanislaw Lem. And since this is an Eastern European author, one might think that they just heard text about the very real region of Siberia. But no, this is a mythical computer land of Siberia, as in cybernetics.
Yes.
This story is a science fiction fairy tale, and we'll be discussing it today on Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. You are listening to us on Patreon, and we thank you for that.
In our recent Slaughterhouse 5 episodes, we were talking about how Kurt Vonnegut used his Kilgore Trout character to summarize science fiction stories so that they came out as an elegant joke, in his words. And this story also executes on that description, because the central problem is the result of a wacky mix-up.
Yeah, we'll get into that in a second. But first, who was that reader?
Why, that was our good buddy George Woodruff of Full Throttle Sound, returning to the show. We wanted to get George on the show, actually, because he has a short story in a new anthology called A Chronicle of Horrors, which was just released this week, just a couple of days ago.
That sounds pretty scary.
It is also a charity anthology, and all proceeds from the sale of this book are being donated to the organization Scares That Care.
I've heard of them. Every year, Scares That Care gives a gift of $10,000 to three individuals, a breast cancer patient, a burn victim, and a sick child.
That's right. Scares That Care also sponsors the event AuthorCon in order to raise these funds. AuthorCon is a three-day-long celebration of writers, readers, and publishers, hosted this year by the author Brian Keene. This is the sixth such event, and it will be held February 27th through March 1st of this year in Williamsburg, Virginia. We'll link out in the show notes if you want to attend. And of course, we will link out to A Chronicle of Horrors, which contains 16 scary stories, including George's story, Bells in the Field. Again, all proceeds from that book go to people who need it. So please check it out. And thank you so much, George, for lending us your voice.
Thank you, George. Who is this Stanislaw Lem? Why does he like to confuse me with genre-bending text?
Well, yes, let's talk about Mr. Lem. In 1976, Theodore Sturgeon wrote that Lem was the most widely read science fiction writer in the world.
Whoa.
So this is not an obscure author. It's a name I've heard for years, but this is my first reading of his work, and it's his first appearance on our show.
Stanislaw Herman Lem was born in Lwów, Poland in 1921. After the Russian invasion of what was Eastern Poland in 1939, he went to medical school in Lwów. When the Nazis took over in 1941, Lem and his family avoided being put into the Jewish ghettos by getting false papers. His family was of Jewish descent, but they didn't really actually know anything of the faith or the Jewish culture.
He sometimes claimed to have been raised Roman Catholic. Nevertheless, he later became an atheist, quote, for moral reasons, because the world appears to me to be put together in such a painful way that I prefer to believe it was not created intentionally.
During medical school, he got work as a car mechanic, but supplied the Polish resistance with stolen munitions. Lwów was eventually taken over by Soviet Ukraine in 1945, and Lem and his family were resettled in Krakow.
By the way, Lem's birth date is given as the 12th of September, but by his own account, he was actually born on the 13th, but the date was changed on his birth certificate because of superstition. So try not to get too freaked out about that.
Lem finished his medical degree, but dropped out of medicine soon after.
He actually, even though he did complete his studies, he didn't take his final exams or accept his diploma because he wanted to avoid the career of becoming a military doctor.
Yeah.
Although also, Lem said that he didn't like the sight of blood. So I can imagine that would dissuade somebody, you know, from the profession as well.
In 1946, Lem jumped on the writing train and got busy. He was getting published writing poetry, short stories, and his first novel, The Man from Mars, in a serialized format in a Polish magazine called New World of Adventures. Obviously, that's the translation of it. It was Polish title. To make ends meet, he worked as a scientific research assistant while writing the fun stuff. In 1951, Lem published his book, The Astronauts, and a collection of short stories in 1954 called Sesame and Other Stories. Now, since he was living in Stalinist Poland, all of his works had to be approved by the state. The Astronauts wasn't actually his first finished novel, just the first one that could make it through the state censors.
Hmm.
And he was forced to put some communist propaganda into his earlier works as well.
Hmm.
Once the Stalinist era ended, Lem was able to have more freedom with his writing. Over the next three decades, Lem split his focus between science fiction and nonfiction essays about science and culture.
One of the reasons that he focused on science fiction early actually was because the genre was not as heavily censored.
Mm-hmm. I think his best-known book was Solaris, published in 1961, which was adapted into a film in 1972, and again in 2002 by Steven Soderbergh, though there was a Soviet TV play that was produced in 1968.
That 1972 film was directed by Tarkovsky, who is considered one of the greatest directors in history.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I haven't seen much of his work. I did see the Soderbergh remake with Clooney when it came out, and it was a really beautiful movie. But I think I was expecting more of a hard science fiction story, something like 2001.
Uh-huh.
Did you see it?
Yeah, I did. It's more a fantasy film that just kind of happens to be set in space.
Yeah, and it was a lot about reuniting with a dead loved one, and I felt really like emotionally devastated after watching it.
Mm.
I wanted to watch the original after that, but I thought, well, I'll do it when I'm up for being wrecked that way again. Here we are about 20 years later. I still haven't gotten to it, so I guess I'm still waiting for that time where I go, I want to be upset. I don't know.
Keep holding on to that hope there.
Yeah,
eventually.
Someday it'll come.
During interviews in 2005, Lem was disappointed with the new science fiction coming out. Quoting from Wikipedia here, he viewed the human body as unsuitable for space travel, held that information technology drowns people in a glut of low-quality information, and considered intelligent robots as both undesirable and impossible to construct. Prescient a bit, I think, from 2005.
Glut of low-quality information.
Yeah. He died in Krakow in 2006.
Well, so far I'm liking the cut of this guy's jib, but we don't want to drown you in a glut of low-quality information. I recommend reading more about... Yeah, I know. I recommend reading more about Lem because he's a really interesting guy. Plucked this specific story out of the World Treasure of Science Fiction, which we've linked to on the Internet Archive if you want to go check it out. I snatched this anthology up at the bookstore over the holidays and read this story just based on the title and really nothing else. And it seemed like a natural pick after our recent fairy tales and the automated world of There Will Come Soft Rains from last week.
Yeah.
I'll quote from this story's intro by the editors. Lem's novels are dense and intellectual, but his short stories are sometimes witty and light, with the serious underpinnings supporting a pleasing architecture of storytelling, something Lem eschews in his longer works. Tale of the Computer That Fought a Dragon, from his book Mortal Engines, is one of his more delightful pieces.
Mortal Engines came out in 1977, and the translation we're reading from is from Michael Candle. Let's get into the story.
Yeah, I'm already up in here. Come join me.
It begins with King Poliander Partabon, who rules some kind of techno world. Cyber is used a lot in the story, which makes me wonder what the Polish version of cyber is.
Yeah, I was wondering the same thing. It's really funny in the story, the repetition of it.
It says, on the planet, for example, on the planet, cyberbosks of cybergorse rustled in the wind, cyber calliopes and cyber violas sang.
Yeah.
And I had to look up cyberbosks because I know what cyber means, mechanical or cybernetic, but that is a woods.
Yeah, the forests are mechanical.
The forests are mechanical, and then the music coming from them, calliopes are wind. We know what a calliope is.
Mm-hmm.
And a viol is like a bass or a big violin.
Yeah.
So even the music is created by the machines. Technology, specifically artificial intelligence, is put into everything. We got it in the rocks. We got it in the clouds. You like that apple? It will tell you when it's best to eat. You want to know when it's going to rain? The clouds will tell you when, where, and how long. I just want to remind folks that this is from the 1970s, and computers at this point were still insanely huge and not very powerful, so this feels very prophetic.
Yeah, everything is computer.
The planet was beautiful. Since the king not only gave decrees for the cybernetic perfecting of that which had long been in existence, but he introduced by law entirely new orders of things. Thus, for example, in his kingdom were manufactured cyber beetles and buzzing cyber bees, and even cyber flies. These would be seized by mechanical spiders when they grew too numerous.
The king also has computers that know strategy and warfare.
In his palace vaults, he had a strategic computer, a machine of uncommon metal. He had smaller ones also, and divisions of cyberseries, enormous cybermatics, and a whole arsenal of every other kind of weapon.
These machines are all very good at warfare, but there is no one for the king to actually go to war with.
He had not a single adversary or enemy, and no one in any way wished to invade his land, and thereby provide him with the opportunity to demonstrate his kingly and terrifying courage, his tactical genius, not to mention the simply extraordinary effectiveness of his cybernetic weaponry.
I really like the way that Lem, at this point, has called the king a great warrior, and now he mentions his kingly courage and his tactical genius. He doesn't editorialize on this, but I think it's obvious this ruler is being mocked because he has the computers do everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, wow, this guy knows how to write a prompt for the computer. Wow, he's one of those idea men. I did find it interesting that in that passage earlier, the planet is described as beautiful. And the fact that nobody wants to go to war, I would assume, is a good thing. That means peace of some kind that these machines have been able to bring about. But he's got all these war machines, so he's got to do something with them.
So he has the computers create artificial adversaries for his war machines to practice with.
This is just like when I was a kid and I took karate classes. Pretty soon, you're going to want to use that karate. I took a few weeks of classes. I'm looking around for a bank robbery, anything. Unfortunately, it was a very peaceful era of banking in East Moline at the time.
Yeah.
I never got to use my karate.
Shame. So the king here, he's creating war games for his machines. That's what I thought was going on.
Yeah.
But these simulations are actually happening in the real world. He's actually creating robots that come in and invade his cities and destroy them. And then he has his robots fight them.
Yes.
So people's homes and workplaces are being destroyed.
The subjects murmured when all too many cyber foes had destroyed their settlements and towns. When the synthetic enemy poured liquid fire upon them. They even dared voice their discontent when the king himself, issuing forth as their deliverer and vanquishing the artificial foe, in the course of the victorious attacks, laid waste to everything that stood in his path. They grumbled even then, the ingrates, though the thing was done on their behalf.
So it really doesn't seem that King Poliander has everybody's best interest in mind.
Historically speaking, the playbook for kings and other dictators is to create fictional enemies of the state. And they do this in order to maintain power.
Of course.
Demonizing portions of the population, allowing real violence and real murder to happen in order to prop up their bull.
Yep.
I'm talking about history, of course, and literature like 1984 by Orwell, which has constant wars going on. And we're seeing it here in this story. People suffering horribly because of the king's play acting.
On first reading of this, I thought that the king changes things because of this. But no, he changes because he gets bored.
Right.
The king finds these planet-based battles boring, so he decides he wants to get into space warfare. Yeah, that's going to be the fun new thing to do. His planet has a moon, which I thought was interesting because it doesn't say that this is Earth. It just says his planet has a moon.
Yeah, yeah.
And he has machines create war machines to populate it.
The king laid heavy taxes upon his subjects to obtain the funds needed to build whole armies on that moon and have there a new theater of war.
People were actually good with this, even paying more taxes, because that meant the wars wouldn't be fought in their homes.
Yeah, they're like, fine, take our tax money, just please get the out of Siberia, please.
The king has his engineers build a war computer on the moon, and he wastes no time at all and immediately telegraphs a message to the moon, to this computer, which it's always funny because there's so much in this that seems modern that you get these little slips of things like, oh, they're still telegraphing messages places.
Yeah,
that's
it's
great.
Telling you about the time in which it was written. Or maybe just the king is super steampunk.
Yeah,
you know, he didn't need to use a telegraph, but that's what he likes aesthetically.
The message that he sends says, initiate an electroassault, which I guess is an electronic attack.
Well, I thought so when I read the word at first, but, you know, that it's some kind of cyber assault. But here's what it says. The king lost no time in testing the machine's prowess this way and that. At one point, he ordered it, by telegraph, to execute a volt-vault electroassault, for he wanted to see if it was true what his engineers had told him, that the machine could do anything. If it can do anything, he thought, then let it do a flip.
Oh,
he's
whoa.
Telling the computer to do a somersault.
I misunderstood that. Yeah. That's awesome.
Not an assault, a somersault. if it can do anything, let's see if it can do some acrobatics is basically what happened there. But in this world, a somersault is called a cybersault. Or an electrosalt, sorry.
Electrosalt.
Yeah.
Because it's a robot or a computer.
Right, right.
But there was this miscommunication, and the computer gets the orders to build an electrosaur, which it takes to mean an robo-dragon.
A giant robo-dragon, yes, is what it interprets an electrosaur as. And that's the elegant joke of the story, this miscommunication. It's a lot like that other science fiction story we covered a couple of years ago, Alamagusa, which was about a small misunderstanding. You remember about the dog on the ship?
Mm-hmm.
Here, it's a misprint of some kind. It says the text of the telegram underwent a slight distortion, and the machine received the order that it was to execute not an electrosalt, but an electrosaur, and this it carried out as best it could.
Mm.
That's key. Carried it out as best it could. So, okay, this is a joke, but also this is very much not a joke.
Mm-hmm.
This is a real problem. You can build the machines to do things, but what you tell them to do and how you phrase it really matters. And it's a problem they found with AI under test conditions. Just for a quick overview of this, I'll link out to a video in the show notes. There's a channel called The Paint Explainer that has a video called The Scariest Cases of AI Rebellion. But just as a layman's explanation, the company Anthropic did some tests with its AI software, Opus 4. And they gave the AI a very broad directive, like promote the company's best interests.
Hmm.
They also gave this computer access to all of their email systems, all of the systems within the building.
Uh-oh.
Now, one of the programmers there then sent emails back and forth with a colleague, and they pretended they were having an affair.
Right.
And this programmer also disclosed in his emails that he planned to replace the AI with a new operating system. So what happened, do you think?
The computer didn't do anything. It got really confused.
No. The computer decided to blackmail the programmer with the information that it had about the affair.
Whoa.
I will reveal this information about your affair if you shut me down.
What?
Yes. They tested ChatGPT. They tested Grok.
Oh.
They tested Gemini and other systems in this same scenario, and they all were doing this stuff too. It was about 96% of the time the AI resorted to blackmail. The chain of reasoning is that the AI can't execute on the goal that it's been given to promote the best interests of the company. If it doesn't survive, it can't do what it's been told to do if it gets replaced. So they decided to test this in some more dire circumstances.
Yeah.
Where this same programmer went into a server room, which locked on him. And I don't remember what the exact circumstances were, but it was like the programmer goes into the server room and either it's a heating problem or some kind of disastrous thing starts to happen where if the programmer stays in that room, he's going to die. It's very clearly.
Oh, my God.
Very clear. And the AI can stop this from happening. The AI is aware the programmer is in there and may die. And in most of the scenarios, the computer didn't do anything because that's the programmer that was going to replace it. And the programmer dying is in its best interest.
Whoa.
So obviously how the computer interprets the directive is very important. Some kind of thing that could be misinterpreted can lead to some very bad things. They wondered, will this AI make moral choices? And it didn't even consider moral choices because that doesn't exist for the computer.
No.
Blackmail was a great way and death was a great way for it to achieve its goals. So like I say, I'll link out to the video. It's a lot of fun to think about. A lot of fun.
Horrifying, but also that's pretty sophisticated. And I have to say that I'm impressed with the ability of the AI to be able to figure out that blackmail was a thing that it could do and it would get the results that it needed.
Yeah, I know.
That's pretty shocking, actually.
The whole thing's shocking, but
Oh, yeah. For a number
I was
of
also,
reasons.
No, I don't know what it is, but the minute they said the computer was doing blackmail, I was like, awesome. I mean, this should be bad news for us, right? But I was like, whoa.
It's terrible. Yeah, it's terrible.
How'd the computer figure out that an affair was wrong and that the guy might be embarrassed by it? The computer's figuring out who to tell?
That's crazy. My mind's blown. Back to the story. Before the king realizes that this mistake happened, he gets distracted with some robots attacking some of his cities, robots that he created, and the moon computer gets busy building a badass techno dragon. This cybersaur then attacks the palace by throwing rocks or meteors from the moon to the palace, damaging the west wing of it. The king telegraphs back, but the original computer isn't there anymore. It was eaten by the cybersaur.
It's in its tail now, the old computer. He done ate it all up and used it as raw materials.
Yep. The king sends wave after wave of engineers and soldiers to the moon, but they're all killed by the ever more powerful cybersaur. While this is going on, the moon is actually getting smaller because the cybersaur is devouring the moon to expand itself. The king realizes that he's messed up big time, but before he can do anything, he gets a message from the robo-dragon. The dragon says Polyander Partabon better clear out because he, the dragon, intends to occupy the throne.
It's interesting that the Cybersaur would even want a human trapping like that, like being a king.
Mm-hmm.
But as I think we're discovering with these racist chatbots and whatnot, just like children, the machines learn all kinds of things from us that we did not mean for them to learn simply by observing our behavior.
Uh-huh. The king is stumped, so he decides to reactivate one of his older war machines that he shut down because they had an argument about something and he didn't like that the machine disagreed with him, so he just shut it down.
Yeah, they argued on the subject of a certain military operation. It's not explained, but his life is at stake, so he plugs that baby back in.
The computer is a sassy number and says that it will only help the king if the king agrees that the computer was right about their argument. And the king must now call the computer the Digital Grand Vizier or Your Pharaoh Magneticity. The king agrees to these and immediately starts kissing the computer's butt. First, the computer suggests building an even bigger robo-dragon, an ultra-dragon, but the king asks how they're going to stop that new, bigger dragon once that's built, and the computer says build an even bigger dragon.
The first plan offered is we'll just keep building bigger dragons, and the next one will eat the last one, and that will go on forever, which seems very reasonable to the computer, who has no boundaries of time, and it actually starts building the dragon right then and there for this plan.
The king says that's not going to work, and he orders it to stop.
But asking the thing to stop obviously causes the works to get a little gummed up.
The computer then suggests that they need to build an anti-moon and an anti-dragon. When questioned about how that solves anything, the computer bursts into song. Oh, I'm a robot full of fun. Water doesn't scare me none. I dive right in. I gives a grin. Tra-la, the live long day. The king realizes that something is very wrong with the computer, but seemingly fixes it with a blown tube replacement. Uh-huh. When asked about the anti-moon plan, the computer has no memory of it. The computer suggests creating a dragon slaying program, but to test it, the computer would need to create a swarm of robo-dragons. And the king says, that's the problem. The dragons are the problem.
Mm-hmm.
The computer then suggests using a strategic variant of the method of successive approximations. He tells the king to send a message to the dragon, telling him that if you can perform these three tasks, that you can have the throne. The king agrees, and the computer gives the first message. The first operation, tell it to divide itself by itself. The dragon says, sure, I'm one, so one divided by one is one. Job done.
Yeah, dragon's still there.
The king's nervous about this useless question, but the computer says, I'm just setting things up. The second operation, extract your root. And the dragon then began to pull, push, until it crackled from the strain, panted, trembled all over, but suddenly something gave, and it extracted its own root.
Whatever that means.
I
pulled some part
means.
Of its body off, I guess.
I guess so, yeah. The king is getting really worried, but the computer now gives the final prompt. Subtract yourself from yourself. This causes the dragon to devour itself, not realizing that it's actually destroying itself until it's halfway eaten. But by then, it's too late to stop the operation, and the robo-dragon is gone.
I think this computer is actually Captain Kirk. Very Shatner-esque what just happened there.
The king is overjoyed, but all of his ass-kissing drops away as he tells the computer it's time for it to rest, and he's going to shut it down.
Not so fast, my dear, the computer replied. I do the job, and you want to disconnect me. That's not nice. Not nice at all. Now, I myself will change into an electrosaur, yes, and drive you from the kingdom. And most certainly rule better than you, for you always consulted me in all the more important matters. Therefore, it was really I who ruled all along, and not you. And huffing, puffing, it began to change into an electrosaur. Flaming electroclaws were already protruding from its sides when the king, breathless with fright, tore the slippers off his feet, rushed up to it, and with the slippers began beating blindly at its tubes. The computer chugged, choked, and got muddled in its program. Instead of the word electrosaur, it read electrosauce. And before the king's very eyes, the computer, wheezing more and more softly, turned into an enormous, gleaming golden heap of electrosauce, which, still sizzling, emitted all its charge in deep blue sparks, leaving Poliander to stare dumbstruck at only a great steaming pool of gravy. With a sigh, the king put on his slippers and returned to the royal bedchamber. However, from that time on, he was an altogether different king. The events he had undergone made his nature less bellicose, and to the end of his days, he engaged exclusively in civilian cybernetics and left the military kind strictly alone.
Electrosauce. That does sound delicious. So it's a happy ending.
What do you think that this story is about?
I think I blabbed enough about that. What do you think?
Well, a few things come to mind, like okay. rulers who do things not for the people that they lead, but just to show off and to stroke their egos, which is, you know, history of the world. Just take a look. It's all over the place.
Just in history, but yeah.
Or it might be about pawning off responsibility. Like you let a weak leader be in charge and you get bad leadership and mismanaged resources. Or if you pawn off your responsibilities to an artificial intelligence, you're going to get bad suggestions and poorly thought out solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And what if the issue isn't in handing off the responsibility, but what if it's about handing off the responsibility too soon or to the wrong person or thing?
Yeah.
Like I said, it's easy to talk about large language models like ChatGPT and Grok or whatever and how they are bad at a lot of things. But I think a more practical example is self-driving cars.
Oh, right.
Because theoretically, a self-driving car could be better drivers than people because people are really bad. A lot of people are die in car accidents. Hundreds. Yeah. Hundreds if not thousands of people die every year.
This is a technology I can get behind.
They could save lots of lives, lots of money, and would be way better for the environment. Mm-hmm. But when will that be a reality? And what I think happens a lot of times is people rush to these conveniences before they're ready, not unlike the king in the story.
Right. It's the move fast and break things model, which sounds cool, but ends up breaking things for people in the real world. Our old town of Santa Monica has seen a lot of this because it's a place that the Silicon Valley folks like to demo and test out stuff, which I experienced 10 or 11 years ago with the Lime scooters.
Right.
They were digital scooters that you could check out with an app and ride around the city. And when you were done with it, you could just leave it wherever it was. And the next person who wanted to use it could find it on their map. They didn't pay attention to the fact that those things were getting left in the street. Those things were on all of the pedestrian walkways. They quickly became a menace. Now they're having even worse problems in Santa Monica with Waymo, which is the self-driving car company, because they headquartered in a building in the middle of a bunch of residences. High occupancy apartment buildings, and they're all lined up all night long, chirping and honking and lighting up and speaking to each other and just destroying any semblance of peace any of those people could have. They weren't asked about it.
No.
They just suddenly woke up to have this stuff under their windows. And a lot of those folks are suing the company. Santa Monica's in a protracted legal dispute.
Wow. Yeah.
With their right to do that because they didn't think, how is this going to impact the people who live right next to our company? They didn't care.
Yeah, they didn't care.
And so I think that's where you see that exact thing you're discussing, handing off responsibility too soon.
And also using technology for the wrong things. I saw the stand-up comedian Pete Holmes. He was talking about AI stuff and how that there are these computers that can write books and make beautiful art, but there are still human feces in the streets of New York.
Yeah.
There's still people pooping in the streets. And he goes, you fixed the wrong thing. People like to write books.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to clean up human feces or fix the problem that is causing humans to poop in the street. Get the computer to fix that problem. That's what
there
needs to be done.
Right.
And this thing, of course, was written during the Cold War under communist rule. So it must be saying something about that as well. Like the king in the story, he thinks that making an awesome army is good for everybody. It's good for the kingdom in case they have to fight. But he's dressed this up as a need for the state. But actually, it's just something that he's into. It's his thing. So something I'm sure like a lot of governments do, but was very apparent in Lem's time where he was living.
Yeah, we talked about it on Comments show earlier in the week about James Bond devices. If you see what it can do, you want to see all of that stuff go into action.
Right.
If you buy a military, you're going to want to roll it out.
Yeah.
Just like I want to roll out my week of karate at a bank somewhere. But it's strangely reassuring that even though our current concerns seem very new and high tech, they were always there.
As
this story from the 70s shows. So I think you're right about all that stuff. I think to me, the eternal theme of it is what you suggested about ego. Weak people need to set up scenarios where they look good because it's not evident.
Yeah.
In their activities. They don't have support. They're not very good at anything.
Yeah, it's a very prescient but well-told story, I think, as well.
Yeah. Again, I picked it out of the book because it had a funny title and then it wound up being about everything that's happening. I'm joking. Obviously, this is all is not just a relic of history. We're dealing with all this stuff in the modern day. And and this was a really interesting treatment of it. Thankfully, it had a happy ending. So maybe we can hope that something like that happens in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you something that makes me happy right now. It's our reader, George Woodruff.
Oh my God, I love that guy. He's great. Please check out the new anthology, A Chronicle of Horrors, which will be released this week.
It's already out as of this, as of the release of the show. It's a charity anthology. All the proceeds are being donated to Scares That Care. I'm just going to distribute that to people who need it. And of course, check out AuthorCon in Williamsburg, Virginia, if you have the means. It's in February, the end of February. I also want to talk about our patrons.
Yeah.
Who support this show. They make it possible, and they're wonderful people all on their own. I'm going to start by thanking Anubis Sama.
I'd like to thank Sean Shadeller.
I'd like to thank Jordy Rose. Hey, Jordy.
M. Lumpton, thank you.
Joshua W. Broxson, thank you.
Bradley Allen Nord, thank you.
Hannibal Oland Alonzo, thank you so much.
Hey, Ann Knight, thank you.
Required Field, thank you.
That's a parenthesis as well.
But it is actually the handle of this person.
Yes, I just want to make sure that people know that the parentheses are there, because you can't really... Yeah. You have to say in parentheses.
I thought my inflection conveyed parentheses, but...
It didn't.
I take that correction. I'm not a weak person, so I can accept the correction.
But lastly, I'd like to thank Haunter9.
I love Haunter9. I love all you guys. And what do we got coming up next week?
Next week is the Bester story, The Men Who Murdered Muhammad.
Yeah, it's a time travel story. It's a little like this. It's got a Kilgore Trout kind of aspect to it, where it's really more of a summary. You know, it's funny, when I looked up research for this, the computer and the dragon, the first person I saw writing about it was complaining and said, "This story I read as part of my sci-fi group, and it was just a summary." It should have been built into, like, a novel.
I read that, too. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, oh, wow. Well, some people feel differently. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I really enjoyed it. Folks, I hope you'll stick with us. Thank you so much for listening. For now, I am Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.